broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria, you're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each Friday and listen to the guys from UGC discuss current events, share markets, real estate, personal finance, politics, and the economy. Now here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good morning to all our listeners out there. I'm your host, Stephanie Sumner, and today we've got the whole crew back together again. So we've got Joel, Brett and Louis this morning. Welcome, gentlemen.
G'day, Steph.
Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Welcome back, Louis.
Thank you.
Yes.
Now, I don't mean to sulk, but yesterday I was there in Brisbane and they had a low overnight temperature, I think 18 degrees, and I just wanted to say that everyone was walking around in beanies. So I'm just thinking of actually moving up to Brisbane because it's a lot warmer. Not sure about you guys.
They had beanies in Brisbane?
Beanies in Brisbane.
I'd be at 18 degrees?
Yep.
I'd be in shorts.
That's a bit soft.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a plan to move up, and given the real estate prices are lower than Melbourne, I'm
yeah,
heading
more
up
affordable.
To the sunshine.
Oh, look out.
Good plan.
Yeah. So how's your week been?
Week's been good. We finished off the end of the financial year. It's been probably our busiest end to the financial year for since the business started about 7 years ago. So
Since ever,
yeah. So good to put it behind us. Although we still haven't finished the mad rush because now we've got to get end of financial year reports out. So our busy period probably finishes at the end of this month rather than the 30th of June.
So one door closes, another one opens.
Yeah, yeah.
And how about news? What's been making news that you guys have seen around the place?
Okay, well, look, I'll start it off. At the end of the financial year, it's always a good time just to check in and see how various investment markets have performed. We've got a report coming out of Bloomberg this week that has listed the performances of the total return performances of the developed world equity markets. And does anyone, focusing in on the developed world, westernized developed world equity markets, does anyone know what the leading countries, who the leading country was and what their investment return for their stock market was?
I'd hazard a guess, just purely because I'm patriotic, we'd have to be near the top, Australia.
We actually had a pretty good year. We actually had a pretty good year, but not as good as Norway. Oh, Norway was
really?
Up 30.1% for the 12 months to the 30th of June. And this is a total return. So this includes capital growth plus dividends. Does anyone know where Australia would have ranked out of the 30 countries that are listed on this table here?
Fourth or fifth?
Fourth is a good guess. Actually, yes, we came in fourth. We had a return of 14.6%.
But we didn't get a medal.
No, we didn't get a medal, no. And what about the United States? Where did the US come in?
I'm going to guess it was better than Australia, but not as much as 30%. I'm going to say somewhere around that 15% mark.
Close and close. The United States, Australia actually did better than the United States over the past 12 months.
Wow, okay.
The US came in at 14.3%. And the Australian equity market came in at 14.6. So very close. The US came in at number five. Australia came in at number four. So the top five was Norway on 30.1. New Zealand across the Tasman there actually did 17.5. Hong Kong, 16.2. Australia at 14.6 and the United States at 14.3. Down the bottom was Greece. Oh. Surprise, surprise. Yeah. They'd lost 5.9% and Spain at 4.3% were the worst two performing stock markets in the developed world for the last 12 months.
Mm. Mm. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Now, Steph, we had a brief chat last week about that fraud that happened across the PEXA platform.
Yep.
With the contestants from one of the, was it MasterChef?
MasterChef.
Yeah, yep. How it became quite public in the media. I did speak with a conveyancer in our building here about what they knew about it, and I've since seen some more information. So the understanding that's come to light is that it wasn't the actual PEXA system that was hacked, it was the conveyancer's email that was hacked. But because of a slight defect in PEXA's security, that person that was able to hack the conveyancer's email was able to therefore set up a profile to be able to change some account details within PEXA. And unfortunately, at the time that the transfer was made from the conveyancer, they didn't double check the account numbers and everything, and they approved the transfer to that fraudulent account.
Right.
But it wasn't the hacker that actually made the transfer. They just changed some account details via a login, you know, using the conveyancer's details.
So it's just the account number.
Just the account number, yeah. So when the actual transfer is approved, the way it's been sort of worded here was that the edits were not detected by the conveyancer before the payment was digitally re-signed using a physical USB key and a unique PIN. So there's a number of security measures in place, but the process was what was lax.
Right. That's kind of scary because, I mean, even when you transfer using NetBank or whatever account you're using, I never sort of look for somebody's account details to check they're actually correct.
True. That's true. If it's already a registered payer.
Yeah, you'd never look at it.
No, that's right.
Well, the chances of it happening again are pretty slim based on changes that PEXA have already put in place to say that no extra user or changes can be made without two-factor authentication, meaning that, you know, if anyone was to hack another conveyancer's email and try and get access via that, they wouldn't be able to give themselves a user access without PEXA approving via a two-way process. So
pretty much everything seems to be moving towards the two-factor identification.
Yeah.
I can't even get into my Gov account without two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
A lot of internet banking payments, I'd need to have my mobile phone handy to approve any new payee or anything like that. So it's,
what makes sense.
Security is just continuing to increase.
Yeah.
But it does outline how scary it can be. If it's one thing to receive scam emails into your inbox and be able to read the email and identify it. It's another thing to think that an email account can be hacked and someone can sit there and read your emails and sort of take over your email identity and therefore
There was an opinion piece on this same thing in a separate article that someone said, well, the issue isn't so much with the, say, the PEXA system. It's using email as a way of securely communicating is something that was never set up to do.
Yeah.
Mm. It was designed to be similar to an SMS. Here we are, catch up quickly, that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But a lot of people are sending secure information via email and it hasn't been necessarily structured for that level of security.
Mm. Yeah.
Just on another topic too, I was just thinking about this the other day that, we've set up all these online communication platforms to make life easier. And as I was sitting there working at 8 o'clock at night, I thought we've made it harder for ourselves because we are always connected. What do you guys think about, the amount of work that we're doing out of hours now?
Well, I'm guilty. I mean, I'm rarely off the computer at home, looking at either looking at information or trying to update information or look at a better process or whatever it might be. So yeah, I agree. I'm doing more now than I ever have.
Yeah, I think we just seem to be even losing touch with having a conversation with somebody because, I'm always on my phone, and if I'm asked a question, I'm half head in that sort of phone conversation, and you sort of forget that there's actually a world going on around you. So. Mm.
Well, our brains are, millions of years old and not really designed to handle our smartphones are giving to us.
Mm.
And it really drives these habit loops. If you look at human behaviour, human psychology, but particularly the habit-forming behaviours, mobile phones are just terrible for it because it feeds these dopamine loops.
Yeah.
In our brains and we're kind of addicted to it.
Mm.
And and the way that I think about it is when you think that every time that you are scrolling through your phone on your Instagram feed or Facebook feed or even just checking your email, that's giving yourself a little dose of dopamine in your brain, which means that you want to do it more. The thing which I compare it to, it's extreme, but I compare it
cigarette
in this way,
smoking.
Is cocaine.
Oh, cocaine.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there's plenty of information that suggests you shouldn't be on your phone last thing before bed. When I'm stuck in that loop of still scrolling, I have to take a step back and think to myself, look, would I snort a line of cocaine just before bed? Well,
sure, some people would.
No, not me personally.
Is it a Friday night or a Saturday night?
No, that's right. Yeah, yeah. First thing in the morning, though. No, I'm joking. But I do
Wall
think.
We've got Wall Street over here.
No, I do make that extreme comparison in my own mind just to reinforce my need to actually put down my phone and not check it first thing in the morning, not check it last thing at night, and even during the day, just being aware of how much I'm using it because it does have that habitual effect on my brain.
The other thing that I was talking about the other day with a group of my friends was how you actually cut into the market now with advertising, considering we're just being flooded. I mean, how do you guys go about your social media?
That's a real challenge.
Yeah.
What do you do?
How do you stand out?
Well, I mean, it's hard now to stand out because any marketplace or any advertising you're going to do, someone else is always going to be there.
Yeah.
And more than likely, some of your competitors are going to be there. So I think a big part of the advertising mix at the moment is having images that capture attention. It's not necessarily text these days. So you have to somehow come up with graphical images and maybe some text overlays that get people's attention. But that's only part of the battle. You've now got to make them take action on that attention. And, yeah, you know, they're becoming a little bit immune to it all.
So true.
And that's the thing with any strategy that works. It used to be the case 10 years ago, if someone came up with a marketing or advertising strategy that worked, they could maybe run with that for 6 to 12 months before too many people would copy it and then people become immune to it. Whereas these days, you've got maybe a month to work your strategy until other people start copying it, and then within 3 months, people are immune to it, and you need to get on to the next one.
Yeah,
I heard a quote just the other day from someone saying, you know, the world in the future will never move as slowly as what it does today.
This is slow.
This is slow compared to next year and the years after it. And, you know, we're always seeming to be looking behind us, thinking, oh, how fast does the world move now? Well, it's not going to move any slower.
So true.
Wow.
Yeah, which is exhausting.
Yeah.
Thank God it's Friday. I'm exhausted just thinking about this.
Well, and maybe that, you know, comes down to, as Louis said about, you know, switching off the phone. One thing I know I do when I have a social function or something where I know I want to be present for is I just leave my phone away from myself so that if I've got people in front of me and I'm having a conversation, I'm not going to have the temptation or the distraction.
Yeah.
So that I know I can be present. I can actually switch off to some degree from that side of things and be present with the people I'm with at the time.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys. Have you ever left home with your phone back at home?
It's like a horrible feeling.
Yeah, it's
like
terrible.
Somebody's stolen your wallet.
You end up getting these withdrawals. Like, oh my God, what do I do with my hands? You know.
Or if your phone battery ever cuts out, you feel like you're completely disconnected from the entire world. So I had to use a payphone the other day when my phone went out, and I thought, gee, it's something foreign from.
That's a blowback.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
They still exist.
They do.
What?
Yeah.
Payphone.
And you didn't have any coins either, so
no,
you reverse charged it. No one uses cash.
Well, a couple of people I've spoken to recently say they would feel worse about leaving their phone or losing their phone than their wallet.
Yeah.
Probably more
that.
Private information, more personal information, more reliance.
Well, I mean, you can do everything online with your banking, so that's the only thing that I'd need it for.
Well, you can even swipe your iPhone these days and use it as a credit card.
Yeah. I mean, and I lose a lot more money by losing my phone.
Yeah.
I don't carry, you know, hundreds of dollars in cash in my phone.
Yep.
It doesn't cost me hundreds of dollars to replace my wallet.
Mm-hmm.
So,
valuable.
All right, so moving on to our round table conversation. Who's got a topic to start with?
Yeah, go ahead, Brett.
I know you were talking
just before we started today. You had something pretty interesting.
Well, I wanted to bring up the topic of the fixed fee real estate agents, and in particular Purple Bricks. It's been pretty hard to miss who Purple Bricks are with their advertising. They've been, you know, broadcasting mainly on TV, and they've sponsored one of the housing renovation shows. So they've been active in the marketplace in pushing their wares. But the story behind the scenes isn't such a pretty picture.
Well, just before you get into that, just for those people who don't know the difference between Purple Bricks and a traditional real estate agent, do you want to just outline?
Yeah. So their advertising pushes the point that they're a fixed fee real estate agent, whereas traditionally real estate agents in Australia, and we're talking, you know, traditional real estate agents are the ones that sell houses and apartments, residential property on a day-to-day basis, you know, do the open homes, do the auctions, you know, manage the process on behalf of the vendors. So Purple Bricks have tried to disrupt the market by coming in and saying, we won't charge a commission, because typically real estate agents, you know, will charge you a percentage of the sale price as their commission for achieving a result. And then they will also charge you, even though they necessarily can't put a margin on it, but you will pay some advertising costs.
So the now that fixed fee is generally below what a traditional brokerage
significantly below. So they have a flat fee, and it's approximately $6,000.
Now, sounds good, though, if you're transparent.
It really does.
And also, they facilitate your own, so self-advertising and self-promotion of the property as well, I believe. Is
that right? Not necessarily. So there are others, other agents out there that have a for sale by vendor sort of thing where you liaise directly with buyers. But Purple Bricks do still put it online as, you know, their brand is still the agent that you'll see on realestate.com and everything else. But they can sit, yeah, so they can allow you to have direct contacts and try and do the negotiation, and then that fixed fee is just purely for them listing and putting it out there.
Yeah, because I've been through a few of these properties where Purple Bricks vendors have themselves been showing me the property.
Yeah. So, and part of the reason why, and it's not clear in their advertising, there's all sorts of backlash about that too, is, you know, the ads are really good. If you've seen any of them, they're catchy. They, you know, they spell the point out well. They've got some good actors in there, you know, sort of showing emotion when they've realised that they've paid more than they believe they should have. But what's not included in that is that the fixed fee, you know, doesn't include the agent attending open homes. It doesn't include them, you know, doing negotiations to the level that it may be required. So it's almost like it's just a fixed advertising fee.
Right. Okay.
It's not necessarily a fixed fee for managing the whole sale. And what it's leading to is a lot of the Purple Bricks agents are just not selling properties.
And these are former real estate agents under the old model or maybe new real estate agents that are new to the industry.
And that's part of what's been coming out is that, especially in WA, where one other agent there has really taken them to task and said a lot of the current agents that are listed under Purple Bricks, because of the way they do their model, it should only be fully licensed real estate agents, not only agents representative qualified people that are allowed to trade via the Purple Bricks model. And he's claiming that a lot of the people that are trading as Purple Bricks in WA are brand new to the industry.
Right. Okay.
And there's been a mass exodus of real estate agents with Purple Bricks, especially in New South Wales over the last few months as well. And look, some of the damning stats. In the first 2 weeks of June, documents show that 27 New South Wales Purple Bricks agents won a combined 26 listings, so less than one each. And they were converting only 21% of the 123 appraisals they conducted.
Wow.
So pretty poor, poor result. But for the agents, of the $6,000 fixed fee, the agent only gets 1,000 of that.
And what would a typical real estate agent collecting commission?
Well, if you think about the average commission is approximately 2%.
Right.
And, so if
and
you
out
think
of that, how does that get split between?
And that comes down to every office is subtly different. But typically, if you're an agent's representative, that all you're doing is selling, you're not an active manager or owner of the agency, you would probably get a third to half of whatever the total commission is.
Depending on if you found the listing, and then also if you found
the buyer.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah. So every office has its own model, but let's assume that 2% is the average commission. So if you think about it as a $500,000 property sale, it's approximately $10,000 in commission. Now, advertising costs are usually all met by the vendor as well. So you might pay another $2,000 or $3,000 in advertising. So your total cost as a vendor might be $13,000. Of the $3,000 doesn't go to anyone other than realestate.com or the papers or whatever advertising. Of the $10,000 that's earned, let's assume that at least a third of that is going to the agent that closed the deal. So $3,000. Right. So three times more in that relationship. Now, if it's a high-priced property, obviously that goes up.
Yep.
But the agent's working a lot harder for it.
Absolutely. And the agent's motivated because they don't get that payment without a transaction. Mm. Purple Bricks get their payment regardless of whether they sell.
So right. It sounds just like a flawed model, really.
And that's right.
And we know about how powerful incentives are.
Mm. Yep. And this is some
it's
of
true. It does motivate you, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, if you're working towards a target, it is motivating to get, you know, to get a reward at the end of it.
Find a buyer, work harder to get the deal closed, and maybe even try and get a higher price because you get remunerated with the higher price.
And that's exactly why I don't believe the Purple Bricks model is going to work or isn't working, is because they're motivated by winning listings. They're not motivated by getting the outcome.
Now,
have any complaints from actual customers, though, on their services? Or is this just, you know, a real estate agent just going in and having a bit of a shot at them because...
Look, a combination. So I haven't read any, you know, specific complaints by vendors, but what's been evident in some of the data I've read is that the listings by Purple Bricks are staying on the market a lot longer than other listings by other agents.
Right.
So if I'm a vendor and I'm motivated to sell but I want to save costs, and I go with Purple Bricks thinking I'm going to get similar price and lower
but
cost.
But they're not at the opening, so, you know,
Yeah, there's no in.
So is the you're saying that the actual customer is there running their own open house? How does it
they
work?
They can. Well, and look, I don't know fully because I haven't actually been through it and I haven't read the full. But my understanding at this stage is that if you list with Purple Bricks, they charge you the flat fee of $6,000. Now, that's
up front.
That's up front, yeah.
So, no, that's not success-based.
No, it's purely, we'll list, no commission. If the property sells, you don't pay any more. You know, that's all you need to pay, and we'll make sure it's listed in the marketplace. There'll be maybe a board on your house and a listing on the internet.
So really, Purple Bricks are more motivated
just an advertising.
And they're more motivated just to get
just
the
to
listing.
Win that listing.
And
that's
not
the
actually
bread and butter for them, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's just ultimately a matter of listing it and they get their money.
There's a disconnect, isn't there, between the interest of the client, which is trying to sell the property, and the interest of the agent, that is really just trying to get the listing and couldn't care less whether the property gets sold.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly right. And
now, how did this model has been used in the UK?
Extensively, yeah. Purple Bricks is a UK, and it's a publicly listed company over there.
Publicly listed company.
Yeah.
And it has been a success, obviously, in the UK prior to coming to Australia?
Yeah, look, I haven't dug deep enough to find out how long, but yeah, it's definitely been a success in the UK, a success enough that they thought, let's bring it out here. And I believe they've also tried it in America.
Okay.
But the results for them as a company haven't been great. I mean, the amount of advertising they've done here in Australia is, you know, has been significant. So, you know, they've obviously got a long-term strategy to win some market share.
Yep.
But obviously losing agents, having all of this bad publicity is not going to bode too well. And it hasn't bode too well for their share price either. Some stats here that the losses at Purple Bricks, so this is based on the UK parent company, are expected to blow out to between 40 and 50 million when they reported their full year results in London today, actually.
Right.
So it says, and JP Morgan is forecasting a group loss of almost £20 million this financial year. And JP Morgan's further investigation expects revenues to rise 240% to $21 million in Australia, but for losses to increase to $17 million before the business breaks even in 2020 here in Australia.
Right, okay. I wonder why they believe they're going to break even.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what we're talking about is the business model being flawed, but for as far as the consumer goes, but just because it's flawed for the consumer doesn't mean the service isn't going to be profitable. Even bad services can be profitable for a time. My question is, why does this service exist, and why are some people taking it up? And for me, it must be because the alternative doesn't look attractive. The alternative being using a traditional real estate agent to sell your property.
I think a lot of people would see that ad and think, okay, I can get it done for a cheaper price. But I guess it's sort of buyer beware, isn't it?
See, Louis, you and I have had lots of experience in this. What we've got to try and as business owners and as financial advisors selling financial advice. You know, there's lots of financial advisors out there. Mm. Now, if you're just looking at price, then that's one thing. But really what you should be looking at, what's the value that that professional can bring to you? Is it better off paying the higher price because, you know, you might incur an extra $5,000, $7,000 in the sale of your price, but you can achieve an extra $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 in the sale price? Net, yes, you're paying a higher amount in fees, but net after all fees, you're in a much better position. Unfortunately, too many people focus on what is the price and not what is the value that they're getting.
Also, I think as an average, you know, customer watching their ads on TV, you sit there and think, well, they've obviously got a sustainable business. They're spending a lot on marketing. You know, they're marketing the right way. You know, it's a known company, and you know, you wouldn't sort of second question what you're getting into if you're an average mum and dad that are just, you know, thinking that's a great way to list their property.
But I also think there's a problem with the experiences that people have with real estate agents.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do a 5-day course and become a real estate agent.
Providing someone will give you the job. You can't go and trade on your own right after that. You can get a qualification that someone can take you on.
That's right. It's 5 days to get a qualification to apply for a job to be a real estate agent.
Mm. Yeah.
And if you've got no experience, then you need to work under someone else's license.
Yeah.
Once you've been under someone else's license for, what is it, 1 year, you can apply for your own license.
Well, you still need to do further training.
Still need to do further training, of course.
But yes, it is pretty lax in terms of how quickly you can become a, you know.
For, For me, my understanding is there's three things that you need to look for in a real estate agent who can do a good job. There's coming up with the right marketing strategy for your property to sell it. Then there's the execution of that marketing strategy, whether they do the right ad copy for the online marketing, whether they've got an email database that they can send that marketing to, which then attracts enough people to the home opens. And then the third thing a good real estate agent will do is negotiate with the one or two or three people who are truly interested in buying.
Yeah.
And I just get the impression that there are a lot of real estate agents that are not at the level where they have the skills or resources to do all three.
Mm. Correct.
And I think that's the other thing too. People with that model, with the Purple Bricks model, I guess Australians are kind of over being ripped off by things. And I guess if it's transparent and that they can see that it's just a set fixed cost, that's why people would probably be enticed to actually go along and go with it without really knowing the detail of it.
Yeah. You can see why. The advertising has been really good. But I think if you're someone that is a homeowner and you've got a lot of your wealth in your home and you want to realise that wealth, you really have to consider all of the factors at play.
Mm. All right, so moving on to our next round table conversation. Louis, what have you got for today?
Well, we're into a new tax year. The 1st of July has ticked over, so we switch mode from what do we do at the end of the financial year to what do we do when the entire financial year is ahead of us. And it used to be the case that we need to do lots of planning to spread our strategies over a full financial year. It's not so much the case anymore. There's a few more flexibilities in how we can contribute money into superannuation to get tax deductions. So that helps. So there are more strategies that we can leave and are better left until May or June for the tax year planning. The things that you should be planning for now are what are my overall wealth creation strategies and how does tax become an impact? Although you never pick an investment strategy purely for the tax benefits, but if you do have a motivation to try and reduce your tax, well then you should be looking at what investment strategies can I do now when the whole tax year is ahead of me. So that's the first thing. The second thing is a traditional savings plan to make sure that you have enough money in your pocket when it comes to June next year so that you can execute on some of these strategies.
Definitely.
And then the last thing is something specific. Before I talk about something specific, would anyone else have anything to add to those two things?
Look, I just want to come down to... I'm still surprised with how many ordinary... everyday people just don't focus on saving. It's just like, you know, it's wealth creation 101. If you can't save, how are you going to be able to have enough money to be able to make your initial investment? I just see so many people that just don't tend to sort of grasp that idea. And you just got to start saving something, you know. And what I've found is our clients who come in, who actually can then get themselves into that position where we can rejig their finances and find some cost efficiencies, some tax efficiencies, improve some of their cash flow strategies, that a small amount of savings gets them excited because they start to see progress. And then that leads to them trying to find and be more disciplined around what they do then going forward. And all of a sudden, it just becomes this snowball. But when they've never saved before, they don't understand... Well, they don't ever get that feeling of satisfaction and of progress. And it's only really sort of a couple of years of actually doing this. Mm. So all of a sudden you go, geez, I had nothing and now I've got 20,000 in the bank and or 30,000 in the bank.
The one word you said there, it's the discipline, to spend less than you earn.
Yeah.
It's not that easy to do, especially, when you first start earning a wage, it's exciting to have this money. There's all these things you can do and you can get in the habit of just, oh, I've got it, I'll spend it.
Yeah, in my experience, some of the worst people at budgeting are some of our higher income earning clients. There seems to be this, what is Mr. and Mrs. Jones doing next to me? If they've got a BMW, I need to go and get a Mercedes, If they've got a, if they've bought the nice, house down in Williamstown, then I need to go and buy the house in Hawthorne or Kew, It's this one-uppance. Mm. And a lot of them are going into debt to do it. And I can't, and I've got to be honest, it's... a lot of our higher income clients, when they first come to us, are not very good at that basic discipline.
My philosophy on this is there are different mindsets that people need to progress through in order to get to financial security. The mindset of many people is, if I have money, then I will spend money. Mm. So the first mindset shift that people need to make is getting their cash flow right, getting that ability to spend less than what they earn and have money being set aside for their future benefit. Then the second mindset shift is then, if your cash flow is right, then switching towards accumulating assets which produce income and growth, which is, again, a slightly different mindset. The challenge for us as humanity, as a whole population, is linked to the first thing we talked about, which is our mobile phones. We naturally seem to resist any conscious behaviour changes that we need to make to improve ourselves. Whether it's trying to switch off your mobile phone, people generally don't want to do it to improve things for themselves, or whether it's deciding to save money on a regular basis. It's a behaviour change. It takes a bit of training of your brain to get into it. But Joel, like you say, once you're doing it, the rewards start coming in, and instead of a negative feedback loop in your brain about a negative habit, it starts to become a positive feedback loop.
Yeah.
And then people love savings.
Yeah.
But then the next shift needs to happen, and I have seen people who are very good at savings who are very reluctant to then start to accumulate assets.
Yeah. Mm.
So just because you make one positive step, you then need to make the next positive step. Don't use your savings to accumulate assets that depreciate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't go out and spend on money on a BMW if you don't yet have a share portfolio or super contribution strategy happening.
Louis, yeah. I've got to ask you a question, though. I'm not a bad saver.
Yeah.
And I am terrified when I put away money that if I'm going to invest it into a share market or into property, I'm going to lose it.
Oh, yeah. It's scary. Mm. It's scary.
Because you just think you've saved this little nest egg for yourself. And it could all go to custard in an instant.
Yep.
Do you know, Steph, that there has never, ever been in the Australian stock market a 10-year rolling period where the Australian stock market has had a negative total return? Never. So what that means is that so long as you take a long enough time horizon, history would suggest that actually investing in the share market has... I won't say zero risk, but, almost zero risk.
So for somebody like myself, what kind of a strategy would you give to somebody that's a nervous investor?
Well, what I would suggest is that you actually go and get yourself educated first. I mean, a lot of clients that come to us... No, I didn't mean that. No, but a lot
I know someone that might teach you stuff.
I think he will.
But a lot of clients that first come to us have that same fear. And really what it is, it's a level of ignorance or not knowing.
They don't understand the Elliott wave.
I do know that. I've been informed by that, the head and shoulders pattern.
So really it comes down to just a lack of knowing and understanding. It is nerve-wracking if you don't know what you're doing.
Also, it's boring to have it explained to you.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. I mean, for somebody that's not in that, the finance game, it's a lot of knowledge. And, it's not simplified for people very easily. It can be really daunting, really confusing. Mm. Just as myself, it would be nice to have sort of a simplified way to just break it down for
absolutely.
Somebody and
absolutely.
Explain the steps and, why you're doing it. But just not in that technical side, because I often get lost in the numbers and the jargon of financial advice.
Mm. And I think that issue there is sometimes what leaves people open to fraud and getting bad advice or investing in poor things is because it is complex and it's hard to understand. If someone comes across with a appearing credible and gives someone comfort, they might just trust them without really knowing how to dig deeper and do their own due diligence. Mm. So that's where, as Joel said, the education still has to be there.
Well, perhaps if you are one of those people that is a little bit nervous and a little bit ignorant of how to become a successful investor, on the 10th of Tuesday, the 10th of July.
Oh, here we go.
We have our Fast Track Financial Series, a seminar series, 6 o'clock, level 7, 459 Collins Street in Melbourne. Come along, we can teach you all about the real estate market. And then 2 weeks after that, on the 24th of July, we've got the financial market seminar.
hop onto our website and get more details on the events tab.
Yeah,
shameless plug.
Good
now,
timing.
But Joel, they're both here in Melbourne. I believe there's also some others interstate.
Yes, so we've got two in Brisbane, back to back, one on the 25th of July and one on the 26th of July at the Next Hotel in Brisbane CBD. Once again, starting at 6 o'clock. So if you're in the Brisbane CBD area or around Brisbane, please come to our website, look at our events page.
Well, we'll put links to these in the show notes for this episode. So anyone that's interested, there'll be links at the bottom of the show notes, and you can just click on those to be able to register.
Terrific.
Looking forward to a simplified seminar, Joel.
Steph, coming back to your question, if you get good at the cash flow side of things, but you don't transition towards the asset accumulation side of things, you can do that. It just makes it harder for your long-term planning. If we take the number of $1 million as the target retirement savings for financial freedom, if that's someone today, how long would it take to physically save $1 million? When it comes to the asset accumulation, it takes the pressure off the amount that you need to save. Maybe you only need to save $800,000 when you're earning a certain amount of return of 3% or 4% on your money. Or maybe you only need to save $500,000 over the next period of time between now and retirement if you're earning 5 or 6%. Or maybe you only need to save, I've had clients where I've done projections, you only need to save $200,000 of your own money over the next 20 years, and we're going to end up with $1 million because of the returns that we can project.
And the compounding effect.
And the compounding effect, that's exactly right. Yeah. So if you don't transition from being a cash flow savings person to then putting that money into assets that grow in value and earn income, you can do that. It just means you need to be even better. It puts more pressure on your ability to save money.
Wow. And Louis, I was educated a while ago on a strategy to force savings, and it's similar to what you spoke about recently in superannuation with contributions and the way you can do that, and you can salary sacrifice. In a similar way, I think the technology allows the everyday person to just somehow have an automatic transaction out of their wherever they receive their income put aside that they don't even see as there is available for spending.
Yeah. Definitely.
Look, exactly, and we kind of need to trick ourselves. So the human brain is only able to make rational, conscious, long-term decisions for around about 4% of our time. For 96% of our waking lives, we just act in the present. What is in my present best interest? I'm going to eat cake instead of eating a salad. So what I tell people is, as a financial planner, it's my job to represent your future self, because ourselves, we're pretty bad at being good for our future selves. So it's my job to make it easy for your present self to do the right thing for your future self. And automated savings plans, or any strategy where you're kind of hiding your own money from yourself, is a strategy that tends to work. Automated savings plans, things where you even just taking leftover change and putting it in a jar, these types of things where we're hiding money from ourselves tend to work. Mm-hmm. So look, the last thing I'll come to on the tax planning side of things is a niche thing. If you are 59 years old on the 1st of July of the tax year, meaning that you're going to be turning 60 sometime during this tax year, and you are currently drawing an income from your superannuation account, something's going to happen this year to change the treatment of money coming out of super. So there's not many people doing this, but there will be some out there. So if you're aged 59 right now and you are receiving money from your superannuation account, those payments are taxable income until you reach the age of 60. So if you reach the age of 60, say in December, the payments that you receive from July to November, they are going to be taxed. But from December onwards, after you're age 60, those same payments will be tax-free. So what we tend to tell people is to look at deferring payments during this tax year. Don't take any payments until your birthday happens, and then put all of your 1 year's worth of payments in the months that are remaining. So if your birthday is December, then put a year's worth of payments in the 6 months after your birthday. You get the same amount of money over the financial year, but you get 100% of it tax-free instead of being taxed.
Now, Louis, there's also another way in which clients can take funds out of their superannuation account without actually taking a pension payment tax-free. They might be able to take a lump sum, and there's a lifetime cap on in terms of how much you can take out as a lump sum.
You need to meet a condition of release.
Yes.
For most people aged 59 or 60, drawing an income, they are subject to a transition to retirement strategy where they're still working.
Yep.
But if you are retired,
yes,
then the same concept applies. Try not to draw out of your super funds when you're 59. Try and save it for when you're 60. Even if you are 59, yes, there is a certain amount that you can take tax-free if you've met your preservation age, which people age 59 today will have met.
And a condition of release.
And a condition of release.
Yep.
So generally being permanently retired, yep, then yes, you can draw a lump sum. There is a certain amount you can draw tax-free. That's an even smaller sliver of the population.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, yes, you got indeed me on a technicality there, Joel.
Just finishing up on that note there, wise man once said to me, your 20s are for learning, your 30s are for earning, and your 40s are for owning. So use your 20s to go to university, get educated, build experience. Use your 30s to start putting in place your savings plans, accumulate wealth. And then by the time you're getting to your 40s, you should already well be on your way to accumulating and putting together an asset base that can provide you with a passive income stream at some point in time down the track.
Too right.
Joel, moving on to you. Tell us what you've got for the roundtable conversation.
At the end of the financial year, it's a good time for us to just sort of take the temperature on where the financial markets and the global economy is currently sitting. Now, for those listeners who have tuned in over the past several episodes, they'd be familiar with our macroeconomic model that we follow to try and take the temperature of where the Australian and global equity markets might be in their cycle. So for those of you that are new, just to recap, we look at economic growth rates around the world. We also have a look at what interest rates are doing, in particular, whether or not short-term interest rates are lower than long-term interest rates. We're looking at valuations, we're looking at sentiment, and we're also looking at financial stress. Now, JP Morgan, thanks to JP Morgan and their research team, they have put out a comprehensive chart pack as at the 30th of June this year. And I just want to take people through some of these charts because there are some things that are starting to develop that we should be aware of. Now, for many of you who have been tuning in for the last couple of weeks, you'd be knowing that you'd be familiar with the fact that I don't believe that the stock market, even though we've had some volatility in the last 4 months, I don't believe that the stock market is ready to peak right now, and I still think that there's probably a good 12 to 24 months worth of gains ahead of us. However, we are now starting to see that there are some signs that potentially some of our leading economic indicators are starting to roll over. It's certainly not a dire dire economic condition at this point in time, and it's really, these are just some potential early warning signs that maybe the best is now well behind us in this last couple of years in terms of economic performance and financial market performance. But the conditions that are starting to roll over still give us confidence that we've still got somewhere around about 12 to 24 months of good performance ahead of us, or at least favourable economic conditions. Now, we touched on last week US and Australian economic growth rates and the trend that that those growth rates have been strengthening, and also unemployment has been strengthening. I just wanted to quickly touch on the US and some leading economic indicators in the United States. So light vehicle sales, so this is car sales in the United States, they've gradually been rolling over for the past 6 months. This is often a sign of consumer sentiment. We've started to see that the number of car sales in the US have started to decline. We have seen that US housing starts, so the number of new homes in the United States, is now back at its long-term average of 1.3 million new homes that are built in the United States.
Had it been higher or lower? From being higher, well, or from being lower?
From being well lower off the back of the housing bust in the United States. So at its worst, the US at the end of the global financial crisis was only building around about 400,000, just above 400,000 new homes every year. Now, they need to produce around about 1.5 million new homes in order just to keep pace with population growth. That has now fully recovered, obviously, because the banking system in the US has now stabilized. People can get back to borrowing on normal terms. Getting access to credit in the US is now back at normal conditions. So the housing market is now back to its long-term average of building somewhere around about 1.3 million new homes in the US. We are seeing that savings rates in the US for the average person is coming right down. So at its peak about 3 years ago, the savings rate in the US was around about 4.5%. It's now fallen down to around just above 2%. Now that's often a sign that that the consumer is getting more and more confident about their financial position, and obviously that shows up in wages and wages growth. However, unfortunately, those sorts of lows in savings tend to be a leading indicator of savings rates tend to bottom out a number of months ahead of a turn in the economic cycle. So,
aren't you guys just telling me getting in now is a good time?
Well, it's one of these funny things where the economic indicator is different to what's good for the personal, the individual out there. So as an individual, it's a good thing to be saving money. In the broader population, when you look at across millions of people, if everyone is saving all their money and not spending their money, then it's actually not so good for the economy. So as an economic indicator, if people are saving less and spending more, it means more money is going to being spent on businesses, and that's good for business and the economy.
What about this stock market that's going to take a turn?
No, so it is good for businesses. However, what tends to happen is that these types of indicators tend to turn before the economic cycle, you know, a good 12 to maybe 18 months before the economic cycle gets into a dangerous position. Mm-hmm. Now, what this is saying is that there's a number of these that are now starting to roll over.
Okay.
So the Purchasing Managers Index in the manufacturing sector on a global basis, we're seeing the developed market Purchasing Managers Index start to decline in the last 3 months, as well as in the emerging markets. So these are things that, as you're going through an expansionary phase, you would see these strengthen, but as you start to see them roll over, it doesn't call the end of the current equity market bull market cycle. But what it does say is that we've seen the best of those growth rates behind us, and now we're getting into the latter phase of this cycle. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, we're ringing the bell that it's going to finish next week or next month. Often these peak 12 months, 18 months out from the cycle and the stock market peaking. But what I'm saying is that it's starting to happen now. Manufacturing activity around the globe has also started to roll over in the last 3 months. So these are just things to say that, okay, we're very much long in the tooth. And in fact, if we have a look at the US stock market, and I'm focusing a lot on the US, and I always tend to do that because the US stock market today makes up 53.6% of the total equity market valuation in the world. So you cannot be an investor in even the Australian stock market without knowing exactly what's going on in the US. Now, this cycle, so the US equity market bottomed in March of 2009, and it's been in an up phase without a negative year, without a negative annual return for 302 months consecutive. So this current bull market has been in place for about 302 months.
Wow.
111 months.
Right.
Now, the previous longest duration was 113 months, and that was during the 1990s when the US equity market bottomed in October of 1990, and it increased in a bull market phase all the way into April of 2000, and that expansionary phase went for 113 months. Now, we're only 2 months away from seeing the US equity market, this current bull market, becoming the longest stretch of positive returns. Now, during that period of time, the US stock market is up 302% versus the 90s, which was up 417%. So just based on that duration alone, you're starting to see that, okay, we're getting into territory which we haven't been in before. And so that's consistent with some of the numbers that we're seeing coming in right now. However, we're looking at the leading economic indicators, and we're starting to see some of them roll over, but they're only early warning sign indicators. What still gives us confidence that we've got another 12 to 24 months of good investment conditions ahead of us is that interest rates still, or the interest rate yield curve is still positive when you're looking at the 2% versus the 10%. the 2-year Treasury yield versus the 10-year Treasury yield. We're seeing financial conditions. So the spread between high-grade corporate debt in the U.S. versus low-grade corporate debt is still at pretty much all-time record lows, which means that investors are not too concerned of rising defaults on high-grade corporate debt. When we start to see that spread widen, that's when we're starting to see that, okay, perhaps some of these riskier companies are now starting to find some stress, and people are now demanding higher interest rates above high-grade corporate debt, but that's still at very low levels and started to flatten out. So it's not coming in anymore, but it's starting to flatten out. So these are all things that we just need to be aware of and just need to watch. Now, why we don't believe that, why we still believe that we've got quite a few, another 12 months ahead of us, is if we have a look at the US interest rate yield curve, since 1969, the US stock market has not peaked without the yield curve turning inverted. That is, short-term interest rates in the US being higher than long-term interest rates. Now, on average, there's about an 8-month lead-in before the US stock market peaks. So the yield curve inverts about 8 months prior. And that hasn't happened yet. We've still got a positive yield curve. But if we have a look at where the US Federal Reserve expects interest rates to rise over the next 12 months, they're expecting that their federal funds rate, they're expecting that their federal funds rate will rise to around about 2.4%, to around about 3.1% in 2019. Now, if that happens, we will have an inversion. But even when it inverts, on average, we've still got another 8 months before the US stock market peaks. So lots of things that are coming out. And the risks really are that if we have a look, the main risk that I see right now is that if we look forward over the next sort of 2 to 3 years, what could potentially lead to undermining this current financial market? And it really comes down to that low-grade, high-yield corporate debt market in the US. There's been an enormous amount of junk bonds that have been issued, and we have a major spike in maturities in those junk bonds between the years of 2020 through to 2024. Now, if the economic cycle is suggesting that things are going to get into a pretty difficult situation, or that the economic cycle is likely to peak in the next 12 to 24 months, it looks as though there could be a potential wave of defaults at a very high rate in the high yield corporate debt market in the years after 2020. So we just need to be aware that things are starting to turn. It's not danger zone at the moment. In fact, still a lot of positive economic conditions out there that are conducive for investment performance. However, there are some signs that we are now seeing the latter phase, and they're confirming that we are in the latter phase. So
Joel, from the sound of that, just to put it in a visual perspective, it sounds like you've got a range of economic indicators, and you've got a few major ones that you look at, and you could visualize each one as either being green, orange, or red.
Yeah.
And underneath each of those major indicators, you've got a lot of sub-indicators.
Correct.
And some of those sub-indicators are now starting to turn orange,
correct,
but your major ones are still green. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. So if we have a look at economic conditions, I'd probably suggest that of those five economic conditions that we're looking at, you would suggest that the macroeconomic conditions that we look at, you'd certainly say that the global economy is probably starting to flash a little bit of amber. Interest rates are still green, financial stress is still green, and valuations are still green, sentiment is still green.
Right.
Okay, but we are now starting to see that one of them is now moving into an amber.
Okay, so stay positive, but just be cautious.
Yeah, just be aware
that
this is where we are in the cycle, but returns can still be made, and pretty good returns.
Okay, heavy topic. So let's move on to something lighter.
Does
anyone
serious,
have
man.
Any
you
content cannot today?
Be serious.
For... You cannot be serious.
Well, just related to the great John McEnroe is Boris Becker. Turns out he has a diplomatic passport from the Central African Republic in order for him to be able to skip the customs queue when he travels internationally.
Wow, nice.
You cannot be serious!
Well, on the tennis topic, I heard something the other day I thought was quite funny. An Australian tennis player at Wimbledon, John Millman, came out, and I believe it was Milos Raonic he played. Unfortunately, he lost that game. But before taking the court and the All England Club's all-white policy, how you're not allowed to wear any colours in what you're wearing on court, mm-hmm. he was told to go back into the rooms and change his underpants. Apparently...
wearing some see-through shorts.
Well, apparently the shorts were a little bit transparent and the colour of his underpants was more visible than expected. He didn't have any others. Fortunately, his dad was present, who had to make the quick dash to a local department store and bring him back some tidy whities.
Wow.
Well, keeping with the sports theme today, Collingwood loses another bloody key back.
It's terrible.
Can you be serious? Lyndon Dunn has just done his ACL.
You cannot be serious!
That comes on the back of Tyson Goldsack doing his ACL, Darcy Moore doing multiple hamstring injuries, Ben Reid being out and going under the knife again this week. Four of our key defensive backs are now out. I mean, come on. Seriously.
Give me a break, Joel. Come on.
We'll still be there when the whips are cracking. Yeah. We'll still be
with,
there.
With three forwards down, our three leading goal kickers for the last almost decade, Mark Lacroix, Josh Kennedy and Jack Darling, already out of action. One of our small forwards, Liam Ryan, then goes and crashes his car in the early hours of Monday morning.
You cannot be serious!
And now he's not in the team. So
and also,
we've got four key forwards out.
Well, I should mention Collingwood, second on the ladder.
Yeah.
Big game this week against Essendon.
Sign of things to come.
Yeah, so Brett's been upset because I'm wearing red and black today.
Just not this week,
red
Steph.
Red rag to a bull.
Yes.
And that comes on the back of Nathan Buckley being appointed. At the end of last year,
yeah. Much to the angst of a lot of people.
And I might have been one of those ones that said,
I think we've all had our moments.
But he's doing a good job. So let's hope he can keep it going for this week. We've got a big clash with Essendon. Tough week, tough 5 weeks ahead. So go Pies.
Go Pies.
All right. Well, on that note, I know it's a big week of footy ahead, but I'm just going to throw over to Brett. Now, if you're a listener, tell them what to do if they want to write into us.
Yeah, so you can do it the lazy way. Any questions, topics, there must be something you'd like to hear us discuss or a question you'd like answered. The lazy way is to simply go to our website, which is theinvestorexchange.com.au, and just record your message. Just hit the button and voice it. You don't even have to be worried about typing. So when you can, please go and do so.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you again to our listeners. And gentlemen, thanks again, as always, for a fun conversation of topics today. We'll be back next week. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks
a lot.